smelled no burning herbs, no ash, nothing that seemed unusual on a summer evening. Somewhere, there were gardenias. It was only kids when the moon was dark. When the crescent moon appeared, then the children got younger and parents would come up to the hill and walk with them. Parents and children. They'd walk the maze together to its center, and the adults would point up to the new moon, how it looks like a smile in the sky, a huge yellow smile, and little Romulus and Remus, or whatever the kids were called, they'd smile and laugh and wave their hands as if they were trying to pull the moon out of the sky and put it on their little faces. Then, as the moon waxed, the couples would come. Young couples would come up here, courting. And elderly couples, comfortable in each other's company, the ones whose courting days were long forgotten. He leaned heavily on his stick. "Not forgotten," he said. "You never forget. It must be somewhere inside you, even if the brain has forgotten. Perhaps the teeth remember. Or the fingers." "Did they have flashlights?" "Some nights they did, some nights they didn't. The popular nights were always the nights where no clouds covered the moon and you could just walk the labyrinth. And sooner or later, everybody did. As the moonlight increased, day by day, night by night, I should say. That world was so beautiful. They parked their cars down there, back where you parked yours, at the edge of the property, and they'd come up the hill on foot, always on foot, except for the ones in wheelchairs, or the ones whose parents carried them. Then at the top of the hill, some of them had stopped to canoodle. They'd walk the labyrinth, too. There were benches, places to stop as you walked it, and they'd stop and canoodle some more. You'd think it was just the young ones canoodling, but the older folk did it too, flesh to flesh. You would hear them sometimes on the other side of the hedge, making noises like animals, and that always was your cue to slow down, or maybe explore another branch of the path for a while. Doesn't come by too often, but when it does, I think I appreciate it more now than I did then. Lips touching skin, under the moonlight."
"How many years exactly was the lunar labyrinth here, before it was burned down? Did it come before or after the house was built?"
My guide made a dismissive noise. "After, before, these things all go back. They talk about the labyrinth of Minos, but that was nothing by comparison to this. Just some tunnels with a horn-headed fellow wandering lonely and scared and hungry. He wasn't really a bullhead, you know that?"
"How do you know?"
"Teeth. Bulls and cows are ruminants. They don't eat flesh. The Minotaur did."
"I hadn't thought of that."
"People don't."
The hill was getting steeper now. "I thought, there are no torturers. Not any longer. And I was no torturer. But all I said was, how high were the bushes that made up the maze? Were they real hedges?"
"They were real. They were high as they needed to be."
"I don't know how high rosemary grows in these parts."
"I didn't. I was far from home." "We have gentle winters. Rosemary flourishes here."
"So why exactly did the people burn it all down?" He paused.
"You'll get a better idea of how things lie when we get to the top of the hill."
"How do they lie?"
"At the top of the hill."
The hill was getting steeper and steeper. My left knee had been injured the previous winter in a fall on the ice, which meant I could no longer run fast, and these days I found hills and steps extremely taxing. With each step, my knee would twinge, reminding me, angrily, of its existence. Many people, on learning that the local oddity they wished to visit had burned down some years before, would simply have gotten back into their cars and driven on toward their final destination. I am not so easily deterred. The finest things I have seen are dead places. A shuttered amusement park I entered by bribing a night watchman with the price of a drink. An abandoned barn, in which, the farmer said, half a dozen Bigfoots had been living the summer before. He said they howled at night, and that they stank, but that they had moved on almost a year ago. There was a rank animal smell that lingered in that place, but it might have been coyotes. When the moon waned, they walked the lunar labyrinth with love, said my guide. As it waxed, they walked with desire, not with love. Do I have to explain the difference to you, the sheep and the goats? I don't think so. The sick came too sometimes. The damaged and the disabled came, and some of them needed to be wheeled through the labyrinth or carried. But even they had to choose the path they traveled, not the people carrying them or wheeling them. Nobody chose their paths but them. When I was a boy, people called them cripples. I'm glad we don't call them cripples any longer. The lovelorn came too, the alone, the lunatics. They were brought here sometimes, got their name from the moon. It was only fair the moon had a chance to fix things. We were approaching the top of the hill. It was dusk. The sky was the color of wine now, and the clouds in the west glowed with the light of the setting sun, although from where we were standing, it had already dropped below the horizon. You'll see when we get up there. It's perfectly flat, the top of the hill. I wanted to contribute something, so I said, where I come from, 500 years ago, the local lord was visiting the king, and the king showed off his enormous table, his candles, his beautifully painted ceiling, and as each one was displayed, instead of praising it, the lord simply said, I have a finer and bigger and better one. The king wanted to call his bluff, so he told him that the following month he would come and eat at this table, bigger and finer than the king's, lit by candles and candle holders, bigger and finer than the king's, under a ceiling painting, bigger and better than the king's. My guide said, did he lay out a tablecloth on the flatness of the hill, and have 20 brave men holding candles, and did they dine beneath God's own stars? They tell a story like that in these parts, too. That's the story, I admitted, slightly miffed that my contribution had been so casually dismissed. And the king acknowledged that the lord was right. Didn't the boss have him imprisoned and tortured? Asked my guide. That's what happened in the version of the story they tell hereabouts. They say that the man never even made it as far as the cordon bleu dessert his chef had whipped up. They found him on the following day with his hands cut off, his severed tongue placed neatly in his breast pocket, and a final bullet hole in his forehead. Here? In the house back there? Oh, good Lord, no. They left his body in his nightclub, over in the city. I was surprised how quickly dusk had ended. There was still a glow in the west, but the rest of the sky had become night, plum purple in its majesty. The days before the full of the moon, in the labyrinth, he said, they were set aside for the infirm and those in need. My sister had a women's condition. They told her it would be fatal if she didn't have her insides all scraped out, and then it might be fatal anyway. Her stomach had swollen up as if she was carrying a baby, not a tumor, although she must have been pushing 50. She came up here when the moon was a day from full, and she walked the labyrinth. Walked it from the outside in the moon's light, and she walked it from the center back to the outside with no false steps or mistakes. What happened to her? She lived, he said shortly. We crested the hill, but I could not see what I was looking at. It was too dark. They delivered her of the thing inside her. It lived as well for a while. He paused. Then he tapped my arm. Look over there. I turned and looked. The size of the moon astonished me. I know it's an optical illusion, that the moon grows no smaller as it rises, but this moon seemed to take up so much of the horizon as it rose that I found myself thinking of the old Frank Frazetta paperback covers, where men with their swords raised would be silhouetted in front of huge moons. And I remembered paintings of wolves howling on hilltops, black cutouts against the circle of snow-white moon that framed them. The enormous moon that was rising was the creamy yellow of freshly churned butter. "Is the moon full?" I asked.
"That's a full moon, all right."
He sounded satisfied.
"And there's the labyrinth."
We walked towards it. I had expected to see ash on the ground, or nothing. Instead, in the buttery moonlight, I saw a maze, complex and elegant, made of circles and walls inside a huge square. I could not judge distances properly in that light, but I thought that each side of the square must be 200 feet or more. The plants that outlined the maze were low to the ground, though. None of them was more than a foot tall. I bent down, picked a needle-like leaf, black in the moonlight, and crushed it between finger and thumb. I inhaled and thought of raw lamb, carefully dismembered and prepared, and placed in an oven on a bed of branches and needles.
"I thought you people burned all this to the ground," I said.
"We did. They aren't hedges, not any longer. But things grow again in their season. There's no killing some things. Rosemary's tough."
"Where's the entrance?"
"You're standing in it," he said.
He was an old man who walked with a stick and talked to strangers. Nobody would ever miss him.
"So what happened up here when the moon was full?"
"All locals didn't walk the labyrinth then. That was the one night that paid for all."
I took a step into the maze. There was nothing difficult about it, not with the bushes that marked it, no higher than my shins, no higher than a kitchen garden. If I got lost, I could simply step over the bushes, walk back out. But for now I followed the path in the labyrinth. It was easy to make out in the light of the full moon. I could hear my guide as he continued to talk.
"Some folk thought even that price was too high. That was why we came up here, why we burned the lunar labyrinth. We came up that hill when the moon was dark, and we carried burning torches, like in the old black and white movies. We all did, even me. But you can't kill everything. It don't work like that."
"Why rosemary?" I asked.
"Rosemary's for remembering," he told me.
The butter yellow moon was rising faster than I imagined or expected. Now it was a pale ghost face in the sky, calm and compassionate, and its color was white, bone white.
The man said, "There's always a chance that you could get out safely. Even on the night of the full moon, first you have to get to the center of the labyrinth. There's a fountain there. You'll see. You can't mistake it. Then you have to make it back from the center. No missteps, no dead ends, no mistakes on the way in or on the way out. It's probably easier now than it was when the bushes were high. It's a chance. Otherwise, the labyrinth gets to cure you of all that ails you. Of course, you'll have to run."
I looked back. I could not see my guide. Not any longer. There was something in front of me, beyond the bush path pattern, a black shadow padding silently along the perimeter of the square. It was the size of a large dog, but it did not move like a dog. It threw back its head and howled to the moon with amusement and with merriment. The huge flat table at the top of the hill echoed with joyous howls, and, my left knee aching from the long hill climb, I stumbled forward. The maze had a pattern. I could trace it. Above me, the moon shone bright as day. She had always accepted my gifts in the past. She would not play me false at the end.
"Run,"
said a voice that was almost a growl. I ran, like a lamb, to his laughter.
The Thing About Cassandra. So there's Scally and me, wearing Starsky and Hutch wigs, complete with sideburns, at 5 o'clock in the morning by the side of a canal in Amsterdam. There had been 10 of us that night, including Rob, the groom, last seen handcuffed to a bed in the red light district with shaving foam covering his nether regions, and his future brother-in-law giggling and patting the hooker holding the straight razor on the arse, which was the point I looked at Scally, and he looked at me, and he said, "Maximum deniability?" And I nodded because there are some questions you don't want to be able to answer when a bride starts asking pointed questions about the stag weekend. So we slipped off for a drink, leaving 8 men in Starsky and Hutch wigs, one of whom was mostly naked, attached to a bed by fluffy pink handcuffs, and seemed to be starting to think that this adventure wasn't such a good idea after all. Behind us, in a room that smelled of disinfectant and cheap incense, and we went and sat by a canal, and drank cans of Danish lager, and talked about the old days. Scally, whose real name is Jeremy Porter, and these days people call him Jeremy, but he had been Scally when we were 11, and the groom-to-be, Rob Cunningham, had been at school with me. We had drifted out of touch, more or less, had found each other the lazy way you do these days, through Friends Reunited and Facebook and such. And now Scally and I were together, for the first time since we were 19. The Starsky and Hutch wigs, which had been Scally's idea, made us look like we were playing brothers in some made-for-TV movie. Scally the short, stocky brother with the thick moustache, me the tall one. Given that I'd made a significant part of my income since leaving school modelling, I'd add the tall, good-looking one. But nobody looks good in a Starsky and Hutch wig, complete with sideburns. Also, the wig itched. We sat by the canal, and when the lager had all gone, we kept talking, and we watched the sun come up. Last time I saw Scally, he was 19 and filled with big plans. He had just joined the RAF as a cadet. He was going to fly planes and do double duty using the flights to smuggle drugs and so get incredibly rich while helping his country. It was the kind of mad idea he used to have all the way through school. Usually the whole thing would fall apart. Sometimes he'd get the rest of us into trouble on the way. Now, 12 years later, his 6 months in the RAF ended early because of an unspecified problem with his ankle. He was a senior executive in a firm that manufactured double-glazed windows, he told me, with, since the divorce, a smaller house than he felt that he deserved, and only a golden retriever for company. He was sleeping with a woman in the double-glazing firm, but had no expectations of her leaving her boyfriend for him, seemed to find it easier that way. "Of course I wake up crying sometimes since the divorce." "Well, you do," he said at one point. I could not imagine him crying, and anyway, he said it with a huge, Scally grin. I told him about me, still modelling, helping out in a friend's antique shop to keep busy, more and more painting. I was lucky. People bought my paintings. Every year, I would have a small gallery show at the Little Gallery in Chelsea, and while initially the only people to buy anything had been people I knew, photographers, old girlfriends and the like, these days I have actual collectors. We talked about the days that only Scally seemed to remember, when he and Rob and I had been a team of three, inviolable, unbreakable. We talked about teenage heartbreak, about Caroline Minton, who was now Caroline Keane and married to a vicar. About the first time we brazened our way into an 18 film, although neither of us could remember what the film actually was. Then Scally said, "I heard from Cassandra the other day." "Cassandra? Your old girlfriend, Cassandra, remember?" "No." "The one from Reigate. You had her name written on all your books." I must have looked particularly dense or drunk or sleepy, because he said, "You met her on a skiing holiday? Oh, for heaven's sake. Your first shag, Cassandra." "Oh," I said, remembering everything. "Cassandra." And I did remember. "Yeah," said Scally. "She dropped me a line on Facebook. She's running a community theatre in East London. You should talk to her." "Really?" I think, well, I mean, reading between the lines of her message, she may still have a thing for you. She asked after you. I wondered how drunk he was, how drunk I was, staring at the canal in the early light. I said something, I forget what. Then I asked whether Scally remembered where our hotel was, because I had forgotten. And he said he had forgotten too, and that Rob had all the hotel details, and really we should go and find him and rescue him from the clutches of the nice hooker with the handcuffs and the shaving kit, which we realized would be easier if we knew how to get back to where we'd left him. And looking for some clue to where we had left Rob, I found a card with the hotel's address on it in my back pocket, so we headed back there. And the last thing I did before I walked away from the canal and that whole strange evening was to pull the itchy Starsky and Hutch wig off my head and throw it into the canal. It floated. Scally said, "There was a deposit on that, you know. If you didn't want to wear it, I'd have carried it." And he said, "You should drop Cassandra a line." I shook my head. I wondered who he had been talking to online, who he had confused for her, knowing it definitely wasn't Cassandra. The thing about Cassandra is this. I'd made her up. I was 15, almost 16. I was awkward. I had just experienced my teenage growth spurt and was suddenly taller than most of my friends, self-conscious about my height. My mother owned and ran a small riding stables, and I helped out there, but the girls, competent, horsey, sensible types, intimidated me. At home, I wrote bad poetry and painted watercolors, mostly of ponies in fields. At school, there were only boys at my school. I played cricket competently, acted a little, hung around with my friends playing records. The CD was newly around, but CD players were expensive and rare, and we had all inherited record players and hi-fis from parents or older siblings. When we didn't talk about music or sports, we talked about girls. Scally was older than me, so was Rob. They liked having me as part of their gang, but they liked teasing me too. They acted like I was a kid, and I wasn't. They had both done it with girls. Actually, that's not entirely true. They had both done it with the same girl, Caroline Minton, famously free with her favors and always up for it once, as long as the person she was with had a moped. I did not have a moped. I was not old enough to get one. My mother could not afford one. My father had died when I was small of an accidental overdose of anesthetic when he was in hospital to have a minor operation on an infected toe. To this day, I avoid hospitals. I had seen Caroline Minton at parties, but she terrified me. And even had I owned a moped, I would not have wanted my first sexual experience to be with her. Scally and Rob also had girlfriends. Scally's girlfriend was taller than he was, had huge breasts, and was interested in football, which meant Scally had to feign an interest in football, mostly Crystal Palace, while Rob's girlfriend thought that Rob and she should have things in common, which meant that Rob stopped listening to the mid-80s electropop the rest of us liked and started listening to hippie bands from before we were born, which was bad, and that Rob got to raid her dad's amazing collection of old TV on video, which was good. I had no girlfriend. Even my mother began to comment on it. There must have been a place where it came from. The name. The idea. I don't remember, though. I just remember writing Cassandra on my exercise books. Then, carefully, not saying anything. "Who's Cassandra?" asked Scally on the bus to school. "Nobody," I said. "She must be somebody. You wrote her name on your maths exercise book." "She's just a girl I met on the skiing holiday." My mother and I had gone skiing with my aunt and cousins the month before in Austria. "Are we going to meet her?" "She's from Reigate." "I expect so, eventually." "Well, I hope so. And you like her?" I paused for what I hoped was the right amount of time and said, "She's a really good kisser." Then Scally laughed and Rob wanted to know if this was French kissing with tongues and everything, and I said, "What do you think?" And by the end of the day, they both believed in her.
My mum was pleased to hear I'd met someone. Her questions, what Cassandra's parents did, for example, I simply shrugged away. I went on 3 dates with Cassandra. On each of our dates, I took the train up to London and took myself to the cinema. It was exciting in its own way. I returned from the first trip with more stories of kissing and of breastfeeding. Our second date, in reality spent watching Weird Science on my own in Leicester Square, was, as told to my mum, merely spent holding hands together at what she still called the pictures. But as reluctantly revealed to Rob and Scally, and over that week to several other school friends who had heard rumours from sworn to secrecy Rob and Scally, and now needed to find out if any of it was true, it was actually the day I lost my virginity in Cassandra's aunt's flat in London. The aunt was away. Cassandra had a key. I had, for proof, a packet of 3 condoms, missing the one I had thrown away, and a strip of 4 black and white photographs I had found on my first trip to London, abandoned in the basket of a photo booth in Victoria Station. The photo strip showed a girl about my age with long straight hair. I could not be certain of the colour. Dark blonde, red, light brown, and a friendly, freckly, not unpretty face. I pocketed it. In art class, I did a pencil sketch of the third of the pictures, the one I liked the best, her head half turned as if calling out to an unseen friend beyond the tiny curtain. She looked sweet and charming. I would have liked her to be my girlfriend. I put the drawing up on my bedroom wall, where I could see it from my bed. After our third date, it was to see Who Framed Roger Rabbit, I came back to school with bad news. Cassandra's family was going to Canada, a place that sounded more convincing to my ears than America, something to do with her father's job, and I would not see her for a long time. We hadn't really broken up, but we were being practical. Those were the days when transatlantic phone calls were too expensive for teenagers. It was over. I was sad. Everyone noticed how sad I was. They said they would have loved to have met her, and maybe when she comes back at Christmas. I was confident that by Christmas, she would be forgotten. She was. By Christmas, I was going out with Nikki Blevins, and the only evidence that Cassandra had ever been a part of my life was her name, written on a couple of my exercise books, and the pencil drawing of her on my bedroom wall, with Cassandra, February 19th, 1985, written underneath it. When my mother sold the riding stable, the drawing was lost in the move. I was at art college at the time, considered my old pencil drawings as embarrassing as the fact that I had once invented a girlfriend, and did not care. I do not believe I had thought of Cassandra for 20 years. My mother sold the stables, the attached house, and the meadows to a property developer who built a housing estate where we had once lived, and as part of the deal gave her a small detached house at the end of Seton Close. I visit her at least once a fortnight, arriving on Friday night, leaving Sunday morning, a routine as regular as the grandmother clock in the hall. Mother is concerned that I am happy in life. She has started to mention that various of her friends have eligible daughters. This trip, we had an extremely embarrassing conversation that began with her asking if I would like her to introduce me to the organist at her church, a very nice young man of about my age. Mother, I'm not gay. There's nothing wrong with it, dear. All sorts of people do it. They even get married. Well, not proper marriage, but it's the same thing. I'm still not gay. I just thought, still not married in the painting and the modelling. I've had girlfriends, Mummy. You've even met some of them. Nothing that ever stuck, dear. I just thought there might be something you wanted to tell me. I'm not gay, Mother. I would tell you if I was. And then I said, I snogged Tim Carter at a party when I was at art college, but we were drunk and it never went beyond that. She pursed her lips. That's quite enough of that, young man. And then, changing the subject, as if to get rid of an unpleasant taste in her mouth, she said, you'll never guess who I bumped into in Tesco's last week. No, I won't. Who? Your old girlfriend. Oh, your first girlfriend, I should say. Nikki Blevins? Hang on, she's married, isn't she? Nikki Woodbridge? The one before her, dear. Cassandra. I was behind her, in the line. I would have been ahead of her, but I forgot that I needed cream for the berries today, so I went back to get it, and she was in front of me, and I knew her face was familiar. At first, I thought she was Joni Simmons' youngest, the one with the speech disorder, what we used to call a stammer, but apparently you can't say that anymore. But then I thought, I know where I know that face from. It was over your bed for 5 years. Of course, I said, it's not Cassandra, is it? And she said, it is. And I said, you'll laugh when I say this, but I'm Stuart Innes's mum. She says, Stuart Innes? And her face lit up. Well, she hung around while I was putting my groceries in my shopping bag. And she said she'd already been in touch with your friend Jeremy Porter on Bookface, and they'd been talking about you. You mean Facebook? She was talking to Scally on Facebook. Yes, dear. I drank my tea and wondered who my mother had actually been talking to. I said, you're quite sure that this was the Cassandra from over my bed? Oh, yes, dear. She told me about how you took her to Leicester Square and how sad she was when they had to move to Canada. They went to Vancouver. I asked her if she ever met my cousin Leslie. He went to Vancouver after the war, but she said she didn't believe so, and it turns out it's actually a big sort of a place. I told her about the pencil drawing you did, and she seemed very up to date on your activities. She was thrilled when I told her that you were having a gallery opening this week. You told her that? Yes, dear. I thought she'd like to know. Then my mother said, almost wistfully, she's very pretty, dear. I think she's doing something in community theatre. Then the conversation went over to the retirement of Dr. Dunnings, who had been our GP since before I was born, and how he was the only non-Indian doctor left in his practice, and how my mother felt about this. I lay in bed that night in my small bedroom at my mother's house and turned over the conversation in my head. I am no longer on Facebook, and thought about rejoining to see who Scally's friends were, and if this pseudo-Cassandra was one of them. But there were too many people I was happy not to see again, and I let it be, certain that when there was an explanation, it would prove to be a simple one. And I slept. I have been showing in the little gallery in Chelsea for over a decade now. In the old days, I had a quarter of a wall and nothing priced at more than £300. Now I get my own show every October for a month, and it will be fair to say that I only have to sell a dozen paintings to know that my needs, rent, and life are covered for another year. The unsold paintings remain on the gallery walls until they are gone, and they're always gone by Christmas. The couple who own the gallery, Paul and Barry, still call me the beautiful boy, as they did 12 years ago when I first exhibited with them, when it might actually have been true. Back then, they wore flowery open-necked shirts and gold chains. Now, in middle age, they wear expensive suits and talk too much for my liking about the stock exchange. Still, I enjoy their company. I see them 3 times a year. In September, when they come to my studio to see what I've been working on and select the paintings for the show. At the gallery, hanging and opening in October, and in February, when we settle up. Barry runs the gallery. Paul co-owns it, comes out for the parties, but also works in the wardrobe department of the Royal Opera House. The preview party for this year's show was on a Friday evening. I had spent a nervous couple of days hanging the paintings. Now my part was done, and there was nothing to do but wait and hope people liked my art, and not to make a fool of myself. I did as I had done for the previous 12 years, on Barry's instructions. Nurse the champagne, fill up on water. There's nothing worse for the collector than encountering a drunken artist, unless he's famous for being drunk, and you are not, dear. Be amiable but enigmatic, and when people ask for the story behind the painting, say, my lips are sealed, but for God's sake imply there is one. It's the story they're buying. I rarely invite people to the preview any longer. Some artists do, regarding it as a social event. I do not. While I take my art seriously as art, and am proud of my work. The latest exhibition was called people in landscapes, which pretty much says it all about my work anyway. I understand that the party exists solely as a commercial event, a come-on for eventual buyers, and those who might say the right thing to other eventual buyers. I tell you this so you will not be surprised that Barry and Paul manage the guest list to the preview, not I. The preview always begins at 6:30 p.m. I had spent the afternoon hanging paintings, making sure everything looked as good as it could, as I have done every other year. The only thing that was different about the day of this particular event was how excited Paul looked. Like a small boy struggling with the urge to tell you what he had bought you for a birthday present. That and Barry, who said while we were hanging, "I think tonight's show will put you on the map." I said, "I think there's a typo on the Lake District one." An oversized painting of Windermere at sunset, with two children staring lostly at the viewer from the banks. It should say £3,000. It says £300,000. "Does it?" said Barry, blandly. "My, my." But he did nothing to change it. It was perplexing, but the first guests had arrived a little early, and the mystery could wait. A young man invited me to eat a mushroom puff from a silver tray. I took my glass of Nurse This Slowly champagne from the table in the corner, and I prepared to mingle. All the prices were high, and I doubted that the little gallery would be able to sell the paintings at those prices, and I worried about the year ahead. Barry and Paul always take responsibility for moving me around the room, saying, "This is the artist, the beautiful boy who makes all these beautiful things, Stuart Innes." And I shake hands and smile. By the end of the evening, I will have met everyone. And Paul and Barry are very good about saying, "Stuart, you remember David? He writes about art for the Telegraph." And I, for my part, am good about saying, "Of course, how are you? So glad you could come." The room was at its most crowded when a striking red-haired woman to whom I had not yet been introduced began shouting, "Representational bullshit!" I was in conversation with the Daily Telegraph art critic, and we turned. He said, "A friend of yours?" I said, "I don't think so." She was still shouting, although the sounds of the party had now quieted. She shouted, "Nobody's interested in this shit! Nobody!" And she reached her hand into her coat pocket and pulled out a bottle of ink, shouted, "Try selling this now!" and threw ink at Windermere Sunset. It was blue-black ink. Paul was by her side then, pulling the ink bottle away from her, saying, "That was a £300,000 painting, young lady." Barry took her arm, said, "I think the police will want a word with you," and walked her back into his office. She shouted at us as she went, "I'm not afraid, I'm proud. Artists like him just feeding off you gullible art buyers. You're all sheep. Representational crap." And then she was gone. And the party people were buzzing and inspecting the ink-fouled painting and looking at me, and the Telegraph man was asking if I would like to comment and how I felt about seeing a £300,000 painting destroyed. And I mumbled about how I was proud to be a painter and said something about the transient nature of art, and he said that he supposed that tonight's event was an artistic happening in its own right, and we agreed that, artistic happening or not, the woman was not quite right in the head. Barry reappeared, moving from group to group, explaining that Paul was dealing with the young lady and that her eventual disposition would be up to me. The guests were still buzzing excitedly as he ushered them out of the door. Barry apologized as he did so, agreed that we lived in exciting times, explained that he would be open at the regular time tomorrow. "That went well," he said when we were alone in the gallery. "Well, that was a disaster." "Stuart Innes, the one who had the £300,000 painting destroyed? I think you need to be forgiving, don't you? She was a fellow artist, even one with different goals. Sometimes you need a little something to kick you up to the next level." We went into the back room. I said, "Whose idea was this?"
"Ours," said Paul.
He was drinking white wine in the back room with the red-haired woman. Well, Barry's mostly, but it needed a good little actress to pull it off, and I found her. She grinned modestly, managed to look both abashed and pleased with herself. If this doesn't get you the attention you deserve, beautiful boy, said Barry, smiling at me, nothing will. Now you're important enough to be attacked. The Windermere painting's ruined, I pointed out. Barry glanced at Paul, and they giggled. It's already sold, ink splatters and all, for £75,000, Barry said. It's like I always say, people think they are buying the art, but really, they're buying the story. Paul filled our glasses. And we owe it all to you, he said to the woman. Stuart, Barry, I'd like to propose a toast. To Cassandra. Cassandra, we repeated, and we drank. This time I did not nurse my drink. I needed it. Then as the name was still sinking in, Paul said, Cassandra, this ridiculously attractive and talented young man is, as I am sure you know, Stuart Innes. I know, she said. Actually, we're very old friends. Do tell, said Barry. Well, said Cassandra, 20 years ago, Stuart wrote my name on his maths exercise notebook. She looked like the girl in my drawing, yes. Or like the girl in the photographs, all grown up, sharp-faced, intelligent, assured. I had never seen her before in my life. Hello, Cassandra, I said. I couldn't think of anything else to say. We were in the wine bar beneath my flat. They serve food there, too. It's more than just a wine bar. I found myself talking to her as if she was someone I had known since childhood. And, I reminded myself, she wasn't. I'd only met her that evening. She still had ink stains on her hands. We had glanced at the menu, ordered the same thing, the vegetarian mezza, and when it had arrived, both started with the dolmades, then moved on to the hummus. I made you up, I told her. It was not the first thing I had said. First, we had talked about her community theatre, how she had become friends with Paul, his offer to her £1,000 for this evening's show, and how she had needed the money but mostly said yes to him because it sounded like a fun adventure. Anyway, she said, she couldn't say no when she heard my name mentioned. She thought it was fate. That was when I said it. I was scared she would think I was mad, but I said it. I made you up. No, she said. You didn't. I mean, obviously, you didn't. I'm really here. Then she said, would you like to touch me? I looked at her face and her posture, at her eyes. She was everything I had ever dreamed of in a woman, everything I had been missing in other women. Yes, I said, very much. Let's eat our dinner first, she said. Then she said, how long has it been since you were with a woman? I'm not gay, I protested. I have girlfriends. I know, she said. When was the last one? I tried to remember. Was it Brigitte? Or the stylist the ad agency had sent me to Iceland with? I was not certain. 2 years, I said, perhaps three. I just haven't met the right person yet. You did once, she said. She opened her handbag then, a big floppy purple thing, pulled out a cardboard folder, opened it, removed a piece of paper, tape browned at the corners. See? I remembered it. How could I not? It had hung above my bed for years. She was looking around as if talking to someone beyond the curtain. Cassandra, it said. February 19th, 1985. And it was signed, Stuart Innes. There is something at the same time both embarrassing and heartwarming about seeing your handwriting from when you were 15. I came back from Canada in 89, she said. My parents' marriage fell apart out there, and Mum wanted to come home. I wondered about you, what you were doing, so I went to your old address. The house was empty. Windows were broken. It was obvious nobody lived there anymore. They'd knocked down the riding stables already. That made me so sad. I loved horses as a girl, obviously. But I walked through the house until I found your bedroom. It was obviously your bedroom, although all the furniture was gone. It still smelled like you. And this was still pinned to the wall. I didn't think anyone would miss it. She smiled. Who are you? Cassandra Carlyle, age 34, former actress, failed playwright, now running a community theatre in Norwood. Drama therapy, hall for rent. 4 plays a year, plus workshops, and a local panto. Who are you, Stuart?
You know who I am.
Then, you know I've never met you before, don't you? She nodded. She said, Poor Stuart, you live just above here, don't you?
Yes, it's a bit loud sometimes, but it's handy for the tube, and the rent isn't painful.
Let's pay the bill and go upstairs. I reached out to touch the back of her hand. Not yet, she said, moving her hand away before I could touch her. We should talk first. So we went upstairs. I like your flat, she said. It looks exactly like the kind of place I imagine you being. It's probably time to start thinking about getting something a bit bigger, I told her, but it does me fine. There's good light out the back for my studio. You can't get the effect now, at night, but it's great for painting. It's strange, bringing someone home. It makes you see the place you live as if you've not been there before. There are 2 oil paintings of me in the lounge from my short-lived career as an artist model. I did not have the patience to stand and pose for very long. A failing, I know. Blown-up advertising photos of me in the little kitchen and the loo, book covers with me on, romance covers mostly, over the stairs. I showed her the studio and then the bedroom. She examined the Edwardian barber's chair I'd rescued from an ancient place that closed down in Shoreditch. She sat down on the chair, pulled off her shoes. Who was the first grown-up you liked? She asked.
Odd question. My mother, I suspect. Don't know. Why?
I was 3, perhaps 4. He was a postman called Mr. Posty. He'd come in his little post van and bring me lovely things. Not every day, just sometimes. Brown paper packages with my name on, and inside would be toys or sweets or something. He had a funny, friendly face with a knobby nose.
And he was real. He sounds like somebody a kid would make up.
He drove a post van inside the house. It wasn't very big.
She began to unbutton her blouse. It was cream-colored, still flecked with splatters of ink.
What's the first thing you actually remember? Not something you were told you did that you really remember.
Going to the seaside when I was 3 with my mum and dad.
Do you remember it? Or do you remember being told about it?
I don't see what the point of this is. She stood up, wiggled, stepped out of her skirt. She wore a white bra, dark green panties, frayed. Very human. Not something you would wear to impress a new lover. I wondered what her breasts would look like when the bra came off. I wanted to stroke them, to touch them to my lips. She walked from the chair to the bed where I was sitting. Lie down now, on that side of the bed. I'll be next to you. Don't touch me. I lay down, my hands at my sides. She looked down at me. She said, You're so beautiful. I'm not honestly sure whether you're my type. You would have been when I was 15, though. Nice and sweet and unthreatening. Artistic. Ponies. A riding stable. And I bet you never make a move on a girl unless you're sure she's ready, do you?
No. I said. I don't suppose that I do. She lay down beside me. You can touch me now, said Cassandra. I had started thinking about Stuart again, late last year. Stress, I think. Work was going well up to a point, but I'd broken up with Pavel, who may or may not have been an actual bad hat, although he certainly had his finger in many dodgy East European pies, and I was thinking about internet dating. I had spent a stupid week joining the kinds of websites that link you to old friends, and from there it was no distance to Jeremy Scally Porter and to Stuart Innes. I don't think I could do it anymore. I lack the single-mindedness, the attention to detail. Something else you lose when you get older. Mr. Postie used to come in his van when my parents had no time for me. He would smile his big, gnomy smile, wink an eye at me, hand me a brown paper parcel with Cassandra written on it in big block letters, and inside would be a chocolate, or a doll, or a book. His final present was a pink plastic microphone, and I would walk around the house singing into it or pretending to be on TV. It was the best present I had ever been given. My parents did not ask about the gifts. I did not wonder who was actually sending them. They came with Mr. Postie, who drove his little van down the hall and up to my bedroom door, and who always knocked 3 times. I was a demonstrative girl. And the next time I saw him, after the plastic microphone, I ran to him and threw my arms around his legs. It's hard to describe what happened then. He fell, like snow, or like ash. For a moment, I had been holding someone. Then there was just powdery white stuff. And nothing. I used to wish that Mr. Postie would come back after that, but he never did. He was over. After a while, he became embarrassing to remember. I had fallen for that. So strange, this room. I wonder why I could ever have thought that somebody who made me happy when I was 15 would make me happy now. But Stuart was perfect. The riding stables, with ponies, and the painting, which showed me he was sensitive. And the inexperience with girls, so I could be his first. And how very, very tall, dark and handsome he would be. I liked the name, too. It was vaguely Scottish and, to my mind, sounded like the hero of a novel. I wrote Stuart's name on my exercise books. I did not tell my friends the most important thing about Stuart, that I had made him up. And now I'm getting up off the bed and looking down at the outline of a man, a silhouette in flour or ash or dust on the black satin bedspread. And I'm getting into my clothes. The photographs on the wall are fading too. I didn't expect that. I wonder what will be left of his world in a few hours. Wonder if I should have left well enough alone, a masturbatory fantasy, something reassuring and comforting. He would have gone through his life without ever really touching anyone. Just a picture and a painting and a half-memory for a handful of people who barely ever thought of him anymore. I leave the flat. There are still people at the wine bar downstairs. They are sitting at the table in the corner where Stuart and I had been sitting earlier. The candle has burned way down, but I imagine that it could almost be us. A man and a woman, in conversation. And soon enough they will get up from their table and walk away, and the candle will be snuffed and the lights turned off, and that will be that for another night. I hail a taxi, climb in, for a moment, for I hope the last time, I find myself missing Stuart Innes. Then I sit back in the seat of the taxi, and I let him go. I hope I can afford the taxi fare, and find myself wondering whether there will be a check in my bag in the morning, or just another blank sheet of paper. Then, more satisfied than not, I close my eyes, and I wait to be home.
Down to a Sunless Sea. The Thames is a filthy beast. It winds through London like a blind worm or a sea serpent. All the rivers flow into it, the Fleet and the Tyburn and the Neckinger, carrying all the filth and scum and waste, the bodies of cats and dogs and the bones of sheep and pigs down into the brown water of the Thames, which carries them east into the estuary, and from there into the North Sea, and oblivion. It is raining in London. The rain washes the dirt into the gutters, and it swells streams into rivers, rivers into powerful things. The rain is a noisy thing, splashing and pattering and rattling the rooftops. If it is clean water as it falls from the skies, it only needs to touch London to become dirt, to stir dust, and make it mud. Nobody drinks it, neither the rainwater nor the river water. They make jokes about Thames water killing you instantly, and it is not true. There are mudlarks who will dive deep for thrown pennies, then come up again, spout the river water, shiver, and hold up their coins. They do not die, of course, or not of that, although there are no mudlarks over 15 years of age. The woman does not appear to care about the rain. She walks the Rotherhithe dock, so she has done for years, for decades. Nobody knows how many years because nobody cares. She walks the docks, or she stares out to sea. She examines the ships as they bob at anchor. She must do something to keep body and soul from dissolving their partnership, but none of the folk of the dock have the foggiest idea what this could be. You take refuge from the deluge beneath a canvas awning put up by a sailmaker. You believe yourself to be alone under there, at first, for she is statue still and staring out across the water, even though there is nothing to be seen through the curtain of rain. The far side of the Thames has vanished. And then she sees you. She sees you, and she begins to talk, not to you, oh no, but to the grey water that falls from the grey sky into the grey river. She says, "My son wanted to be a sailor." And you do not know what to reply or how to reply. You would have to shout to make yourself heard over the roar of the rain, but she talks, and you listen. You discover yourself craning and straining to catch her words. "My son wanted to be a sailor. I told him not to go to sea. 'I'm your mother,' I said. 'The sea won't love you like I love you. She's cruel.' But he said, 'Oh, mother, I need to see the world. I need to see the sun rise in the tropics and watch the northern lights dance in the Arctic sky. And most of all, I need to make my fortune. And then, when it's made, I will come back to you and build you a house, and you will have servants, and we will dance, mother. Oh, how we will dance.' 'And what would I do in a fancy house?' I told him. 'You're a fool with your fine talk.' I told him of his father, who never came back from the sea. Some said he was dead and lost overboard, while some swore blind they'd seen him running a whorehouse in Amsterdam. It's all the same. The sea took him. When he was 12 years old, my boy ran away, down to the docks, and he shipped on the first ship he found. 'To Flores in the Azores,' they told me. There's ships of ill omen, bad ships. They give them a lick of paint after each disaster and a new name to fool the unwary. Sailors are superstitious. The word gets around. This ship was run aground by its captain on orders of the owners to defraud the insurers, and then all mended and as good as new, it gets taken by pirates, and then it takes a shipment of blankets and becomes a plague ship crewed by the dead. And only 3 men bring it into port in Harwich.
my son had shipped on a Stormcrow's ship. It was on the homeward leg of the journey, with him bringing me his wages, for he was too young to have spent them on women and on grog like his father, that the storm hit.